Thanks. First, thanks for having me. Thanks for the invitation. So I'm an experimentalist. I would, you know, show you some slides and talk a little bit about how to test gravity in quantum mechanics. Please don't kill me if you think I don't understand physics. I do my best here. So University of Southampton. So we're doing experiments which are inspired by meta-wave interferometry. Basically, it's a double-slit experiment, and you try to do it with larger objects so that, you know, larger mass, and you try to push it in a regime where maybe gravity plays a role and you can see effects of this. And then it somehow exploded, so there are many other ideas now, and I try to give you a snapshot of all of this. In general, the talk has two parts, but I have to say I never make it to the second part. So the first part is more like the ideas, and the second part is about the experiments, so, you know, more details, technical details on what we actually do. So I will try my best to make it this time. So the first part, the part about the ideas, the things we want to test, they're basically these two parts, quantum mechanics. So when I say testing quantum mechanics, then I talk about testing the superposition principle. Yeah? So do meta-wave interferometry at the first end and to see if that's possible. Can I still prepare a spatial superposition state, like in a double-slit experiment, for a very massive object, pushing these experiments? Now there is these models, these collapse models. It's jittering a bit, huh? This thing is vibrating. So they are so-called collapse models, which are different from quantum mechanics, and they predict a different outcome of these superposition experiments, of these meta-wave interferometry experiment. And I will, you know, give you even some equations for those collapse models. And then gravity. So when I talk about gravity, then it's mainly this question. And I have thought about this for some time, how to illustrate this. And I think the best way is actually to say, so again, if you start with the superposition state, so you plot your wave function or modulus square of the wave function, and you have a spatial superposition state. So you have, let's say, x1, and then, I don't know, x2. So you have, you know, part of the wave function here, other part here. And, you know, that is a spatial superposition state. Yeah. So you have a probability to find a single particle system, single atom or single molecule or single photon here, or you find it here if you do a measurement. So now the gravity case in this thing, you know, example is interesting, because I think there has never been an experiment where you could generate such a state for a system which has a mass which is so high that actually gravity plays a role, right? And the idea is that if you could do this experiment, then what you would like to test is if you do this double-slit type of experiment, yeah, with a massive object, if you find the situation that, you know, you measure it here, if you take a measurement or you measure it here, in contrast to actually find something here. Yeah? So in my you know, language, in the way I talk about this, I would say that if one finds something here, that means gravity is a classical field, is a classical interaction. If it behaves quantum mechanically, then we find a superposition state if gravity measures the system in such a way. Yeah. So that is, I don't know if that you know, helps you to understand. Please ask questions. Not one experiment, maybe to start with the slides, is this here. Yeah. So you have basically this situation. You have a superposition state of one system, and then you have a second system where you probe the gravitational field of the superposition state. And you have two possibilities. You have the possibility that also gravity is basically distributed in this way, and then you can, you know, shoot your particle in between and it basically goes through without getting deflected. If it is more like a, you know, 50-50 distribution of the mass, then you may see like an deflection of the mass. Yeah, so these are, you know, that's the experimental scenario where you could distinguish if gravity, you know, behaves quantum mechanically or classically. And we wrote a proposal some years back to test this with optomechanical systems. That was a very optimistic proposal. Yeah. So it's basically, you know, a more complicated setup, which includes optomechanical element, so you couple an optical field to a mirror with a mechanical device, and that is very sensitive, and you can push it in this optimistic, optimistic case into a scenario that you could measure this difference, yeah, quantum versus classical. So now I think in a more general case, so that's the motivation part, right? So in the more general case, what you do is you, that is a plot where there's nothing else than mass is plotted on this axis, where you see, and that was actually a surprise to me, where you see the mass scale from, you know, something very small, in principle photons, and then up to neutrons, atoms, molecules, to something really macroscopic, you know, big test masses, many kilograms of mass. And of course, what we know is that quantum mechanics somehow lives here. At least that's what we think. Or it could be if you could do like an experiment under conditions where you suppress the coherence processes, then of course, believers in quantum mechanics say you can extend this to any mass. Yeah, so you can, everything can have unitary evolution as long as you can provide it, prevent it from interacting with the environment. Yeah. So now experimentally, the facts, the largest mass where we have done this, where we see quantum superposition, where we know, you know, quantum mechanics still works and we can suppress the coherence processes, is molecules of, 10,000 atomic mass units, so 10,000 times the mass of a hydrogen atom. So that's an experimental fact. Yeah. So that is basically, if you want, that is the boundary. So here we know it's quantum mechanics, and here it's somehow unknown. On the other hand, yeah, if you're interested in this, so what we're looking for is a system which basically is affected by gravity in a way, so it should have sufficient mass, but on the other hand, it should still be in the quantum mechanical regime. So we should be able to prepare something like a superposition state. Yeah, that's what we want. So now if you think about gravity, then also that was actually a surprise to me that Newton's law is only tested for masses of something like 100 grams, yeah, so very macroscopic. So that is, you know, somewhere here, yeah, torsion balances and these kind of very sensitive devices, they test the mass here. And then you see there's this big range where basically, you know, we don't have experimental evidence on gravity or quantum mechanics. Yeah. And that is, as an experimental program, that's what you would like to do, is we would basically try to push from both ends to come up with experiments where we can test smaller masses and see if, you know, if the gravitational laws, you know, still, you know, exist as we expect, or if there's something different, and also, you know, push quantum mechanics from this end towards the larger masses and see if that's possible at all. Yeah. And I have indicated here that, you know, these optomechanical devices where you couple, you know, rather large masses to the light field, and then you use this interaction to probe very carefully the position of those mirrors, and also use it to prepare non-classical states of the states of the center of mass motion of those macroscopic objects, is a very promising platform to do these kind of experiments. So now for this experiment to test, you know, the gravity and the quantum at the same time, that is the new proposal, and the idea is to use a nano rod. So this is basically a single object, which is something like, let's say 500 nanometer long, yeah. And you trap this in free space. So in levitated optomechanics, for instance, so you use a laser to levitate this in space. And then you use another interaction, for instance, a magnetic field gradient to produce a superposition state, an angular superposition state. So now that shows the superposition state where you have, let's say, two electron spins, and you use an external magnetic field gradient to separate the two, right? And then to test this scenario over there, what you would do is you would basically levitate the system, do it obviously in an environment where there's no gas collision, no interaction with thermal photons, so you avoid all the known decoherence processes. You generate the superposition state, and then you wait if the system, you know, gravitationally attracts itself, or if it stays like this for, you know, a reasonable amount of time. So time is the important parameter which you have to realize experimentally, and then it turns out you have to do it in an environment where you turn off the external gravity. So you have to do it in a drop tower, in a sounding rocket, or in space, because you need something like, you know, more than 5 seconds or so for this realistic system to, you know, to go back under its own gravity or not. That's just, you know, to illustrate the gravity case. Yeah? So I will, if I make it to the second part, I will tell you how far we actually with these type of experiments and how good we can control these kind of systems in the lab at the moment. Okay, so for the second part, yeah.
Is the idea to not worry about environmental decoherence and generate the superposition allowed to decohere, or do you want to do this on a time scale where you expect it to be isolated from?
Yes, yeah, you want to have it isolated, and also you have to have it in free fall. So even if you trap this thing, yeah, so the interaction with the trap, if it is optical or magnetic, is much, much stronger than the gravitational interaction. So you have to turn the trap off. The thing has to freely fall. And for this specific case, which is described in this paper, which is on the archive, we need something like, I think it is in this frame here, which is, if I remember correctly, 4 or 5 seconds. Yeah. And that is something which you can realize in a drop tower. So in Bremen, in Germany, there is a 100-meter drop tower where you can put this experiment in the capsule, and then you drop it 100 meters, and then for 5 seconds or so, it is on a micro-G. So it's not really free fall, but it's very close.
And you can monitor while it's falling?
Yes. Yeah. They have dropped the BEC, Bose-Einstein condensate, in this drop tower. So it's, you know, very impressive technology. Yeah.
Now, the reason you need free fall is just because there's not a good way to support the thing without decohering it, right?
Yes, exactly.
In principle, if you had a perfect supporting field that didn't lurk about it, then yeah.
Yes, and that is we discussed earlier this proposal of the magnetic skate park by Oriol Romero Isa. That's exactly the challenging point which I see in this proposal, is that they also don't have a technology which gives them, like, let's say, a supporting levitating field which has no noise on it, which would be stronger than this gravity effects.
Yeah. So just to be clear, Jess was suggesting that the problem was that you couldn't support them without inducing decoherence, but it seems to me you're saying you can't support them without introducing perhaps fluctuations in the forces that would be stronger than the gravitational force you're trying to measure.
Yeah, it's much more just, you know, how we use the phrase decoherence. Yeah? So you have to do it under extremely high vacuum conditions, and you have to do it at low temperature to avoid decoherence processes like collisions with background gas and interaction with thermal photons. But then you have also like the force effect of the trap, which would be like noise of the force field, which is technically, I mean, if you write it down in the equation, it's not the decoherence effect, it's really like a force which is interacting with the system, and which is also, you know, pushing it back into this kind of configuration.
But a noisy, you have a coherent force, but then you just summed over different trajectory, you know, different noise terms. It looks the same, right? It has the same effect of washing out the interference pattern.
I would immediately believe you.
Depends on the length scales, right? It could be that it introduces noise, but not the kind of noise that could decohere this particular position. But if I understood you correctly, the real worry is that you might introduce forces that would that might look like the gravitational force you're trying to measure.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. We need some numbers. Hmm? The ratio of Coulomb to gravity is 10 to the 40.
Yes.
So if you put in numbers, your things just disappear as far as gravity is concerned.
So you have to make sure that there is no charge, you know, involved, and that there is like no Coulomb interaction, which would not, because there is just a single system, right? So usually the problem, if you want to do this kind of very, you know, gravity experiment with small masses, yeah, so you have to go very close, yeah, with the two masses. So now what happens is that you have a lot of other forces like van der Waals and Casimir forces, which are, you know, dominating by orders of magnitude in this close proximity. So what people do typically is they have another like thin membrane, which is between the two masses, so that you have like a known dispersion interaction between, let's say, this mass and this surface. And then you change the other mass, the distance of the other mass, while you keep this distance constant. So you have like an offset of your dispersion force. And on top of that, you see a fluctuation which may come from gravity. Right? But it is limiting the sensitivity of the experiment because you can never measure something which is less than this dispersion force interaction. So now in this case, that is one of the cool things about this experiment, is that there is no dispersion force because there is just a single system. Right? So that is... That is, so we know for everything which has to do with electromagnetism, so also dispersion forces which come from QED in you know, the one or the other way, that is, you know, quantum mechanically. So that means that there is no real other system where it would interact with, right? So these forces don't exist. The question is if it's the same for gravity. Yeah. So quantum mechanically, it would stay like this. If gravity is quantum mechanically, if gravity is classical, it would propagate back. That's the basic idea.
So you're creating a superposition here, but how do you know there's not going to be the Casimir forces that act between the two components of your...
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say, is that I think if the force is purely quantum mechanical, then it does not interact with the superimposed state.
But the two parts of the states could be interacting. In other words, you have to solve not just for the thinking of this as an isolated system, but it's a system that includes the electromagnetic field all around it. And you can't eliminate that field because it's always there. So you have electromagnetic field, and so you use QED to solve for this complete state, not just your nano rod, but the nano rod together with the electromagnetic field.
Mm-hmm. And you say it is different if you have a superposition state or if you have just a single state. Then
we have to solve for the state of the complete system, which includes the electromagnetic field. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm wondering whether...
So that means we maybe have been too naive with this, and we have to still do this legwork to solve QED.
I think you haven't been too naive, because if you assume that it's QED, and you ask, okay, what would the rod in this configuration, how would it evolve? There are no other charges around, so it feels no electromagnetic forces. You ask, if the rod were in this configuration, how would it evolve? And then by linearity of the Schrodinger equation, you know that the superposition evolves just like how each term would evolve if the other term weren't there.
But the
gravitational theory that you're testing, if I understand correctly, is this nonlinear Schrodinger equation. Mm-hmm. And so that's the difference, that we presume that the electromagnetic forces are governed by QED, linear Schrodinger equation.
Well, where does the Schrodinger equation come from, the QED? QED is not subject to the Schrodinger equation, is no longer applicable.
Sure it is.
It's
unitary time evolution. Yep. You can always write it down as a Schrodinger equation.
Unitary time evolution is linear. That's all that matters in this argument. And then I think the theory that you're testing is a kind of nonlinear modification of quantum mechanics.
Yes.
And that's...
So I give one example later, which is the Schrodinger Newton thing.
If I put in, instead of E over R in the Schrodinger equation, I put in GM over R, then I'm going to get something incredibly small.
It is small, yes.
How can you possibly determine that this
is... I think that is if you want, the advance of technology.
We're talking about 10 to the minus heaven knows what.
It's really small.
I can do it in my head.
Okay. Yeah.
So I don't see how this is.
Yeah, that is why in the other plot, where no one has measured Newton's law even for masses which are smaller than 100 grams or so, right? It's very weak. Yeah?
It's still classical.
It's still classical.
Yeah. So what do you have to get to see the quantum?
I don't know.
Well, just put in some numbers. You can put in numbers to see.
There are numbers in this proposal for the just the classical Newtonian-like gravity interaction case. So for the other one, we could also do it, which we much probably should do. You're right. Yeah.
Can I ask, what is the masses? How big is the mass? So you said it's 500 nanometer log.
Yeah.
What is the total mass that's...
I don't know the precise mass. Again, it's in the paper. It's something like 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 atomic mass units. So that would be...
Okay.
Yeah. So compared to atomic scales, that's you know, huge. It's macroscopic.
Yeah. And you cool it automatically. So
yeah,
how hot is it? Is it made out of silicon?
You have to cool it to the ground state.
How hot the internal degrees of freedom?
Yeah. So the internal. So the internal degree of freedom also has to be cooled to prevent. Radiation, exactly. Yeah. So the numbers are somewhere here. I think it's, you know, if you go to 4 Kelvin, then you can do this experiment in the drop tower.
So yeah. This is 4 Kelvin?
4 Kelvin, yeah. So what you do is you put this in a cryostat, so you can use just a liquid helium cryostat, right?
Yeah.
And then you wait for thermalization, and then everything is at 4 Kelvin. And but then you drop the whole cryostat in.
But wouldn't scattering from the optical trap also be that?
Yeah, so you that's why you much probably have to use a magnetic trap. Yes, all these effects are there, of course, yeah. And there has to be careful design to not heat up the internal temperature, for sure, yeah.
So I want to just ask out of ignorance. It struck me as odd that we're assuming that a test of quantum theory is that if two masses are in superposition, that they should attract each other and come towards the center.
Yeah.
So has this been resolved for the case of electric force? Like if you have an electron which is in a superposition, and
yes.
things, will it repel itself?
Yeah. So we know for Coulomb, it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. And Schrödinger did this in, I don't know, 1920, whatever. So what you do, if you do the same naive thing, you take the Schrödinger equation and you add Coulomb force, and then you try to solve like something like the hydrogen atom. You get the completely wrong energies and it does not match. So it's clearly wrong in the case of Coulomb. But that's precisely the question. Is gravity like Coulomb or not? Right? It's much probably not. Right.
The Coulomb itself. But this is the theory that we're testing.
Right.
So that's the alternative. The standard version.
Right. So for
is going to be quantum.
So for Coulomb, you have hydrogen spectra. So you know that is my Paschen series, my Balmer series. Yeah. The energy transitions. For gravity, there is nothing like this. Right. So you don't have the experiment to compare and say that this one's, and that is. You know, what we try to do here is to actually make an experiment which tells us once and for all, you know, it cannot be a classical interaction. It has to be quantized or something like that. It's like a zero-line experimental statement. Right?
So what do you actually measure in the end?
You measure the angle. So you measure basically by how much it goes back. That you can do optically. So one of the advantages of these optomechanical setups or magnetomechanical setups is that you can measure position with an incredible precision. So you can measure something like a femtometer of position change of the center of this ball here.
But this is a single quantum state you've got. So when you do a measurement, when you make a measurement, you're going to observe the system.
Yeah, so you prepare.
You have to decohere the system with your apparatus. So what are you measuring in the end? Because you're preparing a single quantum state.
Yeah. So you measure the position of this, so you don't like continuously measure it. So but you do it like stroboscopic. So you prepare the state, you drop it, and then you know shortly before it hits the bottom of the drop tower, you basically measure the position of this. And then of course you repeat the experiment to get some statistics, and then I guess you will learn. You know, if it is still like this or is like this. So if it is still in this state, then you measure 50% this and 50% this. If it has like propagated to this, then you always measure this. That is what I wanted to illustrate with this.
So
okay, very cool. Okay, so that's the gravity part. The next part is these Collars models. So they're not loved by many. But that's how they look like. So the first one was by Girardi, Rimini, and Weber in the mid-80s. And the idea was to actually come up with a model which somehow explains the coherence, but not by having the coherence as like an interaction of the quantum system with an environment, but to have like a machinery on board of the dynamics. So that is the Schrödinger equation, which has this extra collapse part, and that is the machinery which is always there and which becomes effective if the system is macroscopic enough. Yeah. So please don't ask me too many details about this. I have no idea. The important thing is this thing here, that's a stochastic field which you add, which is, you know, I imagine as if you have your wave function, then there is this stochastic field which is kicking the wave function, measuring the wave function, and that is a you know, in some of the models, actually, I go to the next slide. In this continuous spontaneous localization model, CSL, which is the more standard, you see that it's more mass in the equations. Again, here's the stochastic field, and now the stochastic field is kicking the wave function and is shrinking the size, right? And you have many of those kicks, so there are some parameters to this equation. There's this lambda, which is the collapse rate, so that is how many kicks you have per time unit, and RC is a localization length, so that is basically the correlation length of your noise, of the background stochastic field, the W. And now in this model, that's a mass-dependent model, you have a mass operator. And the idea is that if you have a microscopic system like an atom or something really small, then all this stuff here is not active, so you just have the first part of the typical Schrödinger equation. And only if the mass becomes reasonably large, then this collapse becomes effective, and you explain why you have like a quantum to classical transition if you go from microscopic to macroscopic objects. So that is what this thing wants to explain consistently, just, you know, as a dynamical process of the evolution of the wave function, not something which is like artificial. So you have your unitarily involving quantum system, and then it interacts with the environment, so you have to have this extra part. It's just, you know, one thing which comes. There are different versions of this, so Philip Pearl did a lot of this, and also Steve Adler has some models. Okay, and so now I'm an experimentalist, so my question is, how can I test this? How can I do an experiment to test this? And obviously, the best experiment would be to do a meta-wave interferometry experiment to prepare a superposition state. And then if I basically pass this critical mass, then it should not be possible in general to prepare the state. Yeah? It's simply impossible. It will collapse before I could measure it. I could prove that there is a superposition. So now, in my terms, and that's a plot which we did some time ago. It's not really, I think there are more intelligent ways to plot this, but the aim was to actually compare theory with experiment. So the red curve here is a solution of this. We can write down the collapse models also as like a, you know, master equation, Lindblad type. And then you have a CSL gamma, which is written in this form. And now this gamma is the red curve here. And there are these two parameters. So the wave packet size is this, you compare to the RC in the model, and the collapse rate, you compare basically to the time of the existence of a superposition state, and then you look at different physical systems. So, of course, atom interferometry is you know, one of the first guesses, because you know, people can do these experiments. They're fantastic. They can generate superposition states of half a meter in the fountain in Stanford, in Mark Kasevich's group. And of course, you would like to know if that is a system which can test these models. And what you find is the atoms are here. So you're not in the, let's say, dramatic regime of the model where something is going on. And the reason is that although the size of the superposition state is large, the mass of the atom is still small. Yeah. So you're not really you know, critical with all these parameters. So the three parameters which you have to have is large mass, large spatial separation, so that is like the size of, you know, the difference between the double slits in your meta wave interferometry, and the time, you know, this state exists. So now for the atoms, you don't tick this box while you tick the other two, and that's not sufficient. So atoms don't seem to be like, you know, a good guess to test these models. If you go to the other side and you go to these optomechanical systems, so these cantilever and membrane systems where you have a big mechanical device which is coupled to an optical field, then you also see you end up here. Yeah? Now the mass is big, but the size of the superposition state, yeah, which you compare to RC, that is really small. Yeah? If you estimate this with a superposition of, you go from the grounded state to the excited state, and you use 0-point motion of this mechanical harmonic oscillator as an estimate for the size of the superposition state, then you find something like femtometers. Yeah, so that is also not the promising candidate to do the test. What turns out, and that was of course the message we wanted to deliver, is that you have to do molecule or nanoparticle interferometry, which is right here, where you tick a nice parameter space for all this, all this criteria to test the models.
Question.
Yes.
I don't quite understand why you need a large spatial separation, because like in in a lot of these models, they have a kind of a localization length.
Yeah, so it has
to... Spatial separation is bigger than a localization length.
Then it doesn't matter, yeah, you're right. Yeah. That is for a specific choice of this Adler model, which has a rate of 10 to the minus 9, and I think an RC of 100 nanometers. So. Right, so you want to be... So the
bigger than 100 nanometers.
Or something like that, yeah? So 10 to the, what is it, minus 7 meter. Yeah. So that is where you want to be.
Okay, so that's
what but that could be, you could choose differently, of course. That is somehow the thing which is maybe, you could say, a bit fishy in the models, that you can always choose different parameters if you want to. But I don't think that you have, you know, a lot of choices. I will show you a map later where you can see this. Now, again, back to gravity. Now, the interesting thing, and I don't know how that fits together. It's maybe if you guys are interested in this. It doesn't seem, now there is this W, right? So this noise field, which is doing the trick, yeah? So what is the physics of this? So there's no answer, right? It's just a model which gives basically the dynamics, which gives you the mechanism. But what is the physics reason for the kick? So of course you want to say gravity. Yeah, that would be cool if you could make it gravity, and gravity would do the trick. But what you see from the structure of this W noise, it has to be classical, because that is, you know, the bottom line thing which you want to deliver is that quantum mechanics is not the end. There's an underlying classical dynamics, some sort of, you know, random stochastic process. So it has to be a classical thing, and also it has to be stochastic, right? And now the puzzle is, how can you fit this to gravity? How can you make, I mean, you can keep gravity classical. You could. Not many of you would love it, I think. But it's an option. But how you make it in a kind of, you know, generic situation, how do you make it stochastic? I think that's not so clear. Okay. So that's the other model. Now that's the last one to show. That is the Schrödinger Newton, which is, you know, for this test, one of the options. So you can actually derive this from Einstein's equation somehow if you do a semi-classical thing, so you don't use the classical energy momentum tensor, but you put the hat on and you say it's the expectation values.
It should be minus 1/2 GeV here.
Yes, thanks. We correct this. And then you can derive this, you can bring it in the form of this Schrödinger equation, then you have these extra terms here. So you have one, which is an external gravity, so you have your superposition state and an extra mass, which is interacting, you know, gravitatively. But then you also have this one, which is the self-gravity, which is the important one. And now that is the equation which says that, you know, this guy, this here, the superposition state, is a mass distribution. Yeah? So there's really half of the mass is somehow here and half of the mass is somehow here, and they can interact gravitationally. Now, if you would look at the dynamic of this state, yeah, and if the mass would be sufficiently large, then it would mean that the guys actually attract each other. So they would end up after some time in this state. Yeah? So you prepare superposition state, but they attract each other gravitationally, so they move to the center. Now, if you, again, it's a very, very weak effect. And if you put in numbers, then you see that this experiment clearly has to be done in space. So that is mass. And that is time. And so we proposed this for a test with the European Space Agency to just, you know, have an optical trap of those particles, cool the particle, and then just look, don't prepare a superposition state, but look at the evolution of the wave function of this, you know, of this cooled state. Yeah. And if it would be quantum mechanically, then it would basically grow. It would disperse out. If Schrödinger Newton, so if the mass is sufficiently large and if you look for long enough, then actually it would contract. And that's what you could see if you would go for 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 16 mass units, and you would have time more than 100 seconds. Yeah? That's again nothing which you can do easily on ground for the same reason that you cannot support this.
How much do you separate the wave? So is it distinct? Is it
okay? So this is
15 here, 10 to the 15 here. Are you for 100 seconds?
So this scenario is not for the superposition state. So you just have one blob, which is, you know, 10 to the 15 AMU,
yeah,
sitting there. Yeah. So you have like a wave function or wave packet. Mass is like, you know, smeared out over the expectation value area, or the, you know, the probability area of your state. Yeah?
Yeah.
And then you let it go. And then if the mass would be of that side, then the whole thing would actually become smaller. So you can study the dynamics. That's actually an interesting thing. Just, I think, mathematically. It's quite complicated to numerically solve this guy. And that is because, you know, the self-gravity thing is non-local. Yeah. So it is, I think from the structure, it's very close to Gross-Pitayevsky equation, which they use for BECs. But there you have, the non-linearity to be local. It's a localized thing. And then, you know, you can easily solve this. Now, this becomes non-local and then it gets much harder. So there's.
It's not the same as the
Diozzi. No. I mean, also Diozzi claims that he invented this equation, but he has 10 equations which he invented.
But if you're not special separated, you have to take, why doesn't the effect depend on the difference between of the wave function if you have a
of course, it depends on all those details. That is just what I showed you before, it's just one example. You can do it for the superposition state, you can do it just for, you know, just the one position state, which is then, you know, changing the size. The point is that the dynamics is different from the pure quantum mechanical evolution without this nonlinearity. Yeah. So you don't have the spread. You can see in this numerical simulation. So you have to numerically solve this equation, which you can do. And that is the funny thing. That is what I wanted to say. So I answer first the question, then I go to the funny thing. You see that there is, you know, there's an intermediate range where you find some oscillations and you find soliton solutions and you find, you know, a lot of nonlinear physics, which is very interesting. But in the end, if the mass is really big, then the thing shrinks to a really like a delta function. Yeah. The funny thing is that there is André Grosshard. He is the only person I know is seriously working on this model. He did his PhD with Domenico Gelini. And he did basically numerical solution of this equation. And it took him 4 years to do this. Now, I asked in Southampton, yeah, there are people who do nonlinear optics, so they shoot laser pulses through optical fibers. So Southampton is famous for the invention of the so-called erbium-doped fiber amplifier. So that is a thing which is now needed in every, you know, optical network to amplify light which goes through the optical fibers for communication. So they know how to solve this. And the equation which you have to solve, you know, when like an optical pulse propagates through an optical fiber, it's exactly this one. So I asked Peter Horak, who is a guy in the ORC, and he could do it in an afternoon. So we always make fun of André because of this. Okay, anyway. So that's the equation. Now the idea was maybe to conclude somehow this story. There are different effects if you think about how to test the Schrödinger Newton models, and if you don't, you know, if you're not too worried at the beginning that maybe the model doesn't make sense, then you also find that if you have an optomechanical system, you would find a shift of the energy level. So you describe this as an harmonic oscillator. And if you could measure states close to the ground state, you would see that there are shifts depending on the Schrödinger Newton effect. And also there's another work by Chen at Caltech, where they showed if you would squeeze such a mechanical oscillator, you would basically pick up an extra phase, which you could see if you would measure the distribution in phase space. So there are other effects where one could measure this in the laboratory. You know, and if you know, someone is interested in this and gives a lot of money to do this experiment, then it, I think, would be possible to test those models. Okay, so that would be, I don't know, how are we in time?
We have 20.
20 minutes? Okay. So then let's move on to the experiments. So that was basically the motivation for what we want to do. And now that's how we do it. I told you already meta-wave interferometry. So that is the world record experiment by Markus Arndt's lab in Vienna. So they generate beams of molecules and interfere them. So that is an interferometer, which is called Talbot-Lau interferometer, so you don't have just a single grating, you have three gratings It's a complicated setup, but in the end, you basically prepare a superposition state at this position here, and then with this grating, you basically prove that you have the superposition by looking or showing this interference pattern, which is, if you want, the number of molecules which you measure at specific locations at the position of this third grating. And they do these experiments with molecules which look like this. So that is 8 years ago. It's still the record. So it's 10,000 atomic mass units. And the molecules are, you know, specially synthesized for this. So that is hundreds of atoms sitting there, and the whole thing is, you know, flying around. It's in a thermal state. So the internal temperature of this is 600 Kelvin. Yeah. So it comes from a thermal source, from an oven. So it is internally hot, but still you can do center of mass motion interferometry with this stuff. Okay. So now back to the collapse models. So that's a map which shows experiments which have, you know, set bounds on this model. So here you see this lambda parameter, so the rate of those kicks to the wave function. Here's this RC critical parameter, and now that's also chosen to be, you know, 100 nanometer, something like that, for RC. And you see there are three experiments here. So that is the molecule interferometry experiment, which I showed you before. These are two models by Steve Adler. That's the original GRW. And you can see that, you know, none of this is really testing this. So that is the atomic fountain meta-wave interferometry by Mark Kasevich with this half meter separation. And that is an experiment which was done by Ian Walmsley in Oxford, but there are other groups doing very similar things. So what you do is you have a big crystal, and you use a femtosecond laser to shoot at those crystal, and you excite phonons in the crystal. So you basically displace many atoms at the same time compared to the original configuration. And that is, in a way, also a superposition state, which sets bounds on this. So that is this diamond phonon bound. Now that is the what we call the lower bound, and that is, if you want, it's not an experimental bound. It's more like a theoretical assumption. And the assumption is that if the effect would be weaker than what is along this line, then this collapse mechanism, as described by those models, would not be able to explain the classicality of our world. So it would be useless if it would be here, right? So it has to be stronger than these lines. So it has to be in this region.
So that's the demarcating line along which just the gravitational forces are enough to collapse the wave function.
That yeah, so this is
you'd have to have something weaker than gravity collapsing wave function.
Yeah. So this includes gravity effects, but it's not necessarily gravity. So that is just the models which have this, you know, mathematical mechanism of collapse.
Why is there the -5 meters that you cannot scale where you can have this lambda parameter very small? Where is the boundary coming from? What do you mean by, how do you measure?
So this is not measured.
No, no, how do you measure the requirement of classicality? What determines that line? What is the equation that tells you that these are the couplings? And why is 10 to the -5 important? Meters.
That is basically the RC, the correlation length, which was chosen almost randomly. You could choose a different one.
Yeah, but why is the scale coming out of 10^-5 meters? What determines? What is the equation that determines that line?
Yeah, you can get the equation from solving the equation before. I don't have it here, but you know, it's in the paper.
A test mass that's like a single mass, or
what is the test that determines this line? How do you determine the line? What do you mean by classicality? Because what is the
maybe I can help, Haley.
Yeah,
from my recollection of these papers, correct me if I'm wrong, it's that the reasoning goes something like this, that you know, we invent collapse models because we think that we don't observe macroscopic superpositions in the world. So you can do a calculation that says, okay, say I have like the smallest thing that I could possibly observe. And suppose, you know, I could observe it to be separated by some amount. Well, a collapse theory hit better, collapse that guy, right? So, you know, how long does it take you to observe it? What kind of distance scale can I observe it at? And therefore, collapse theory should collapse at least more frequently to a smaller scale than that. So there's
that's the kind of argument.
Yes,
that
but,
sets
but
that
what determines that line? I mean, that is system dependent. Right?
I would say there's like arguments about human perception and things like that that go into that line.
Yeah, this is what I want to see. What are the arguments that go into shape?
I'm saying there's obviously a mass or a length scale here selected at 10 to minus 5 meters.
Yeah, why is 10 to the minus 5 meters? Why is it, what is it, 10 to minus 5 meters? 10 microns.
For what it's worth, this is more or less close to the range of human vision. I don't know if that's where that number is coming from.
But I think it does. It comes from, you could not observe a micron superposition. So if that micron superposition was there,
the wavelength of light from it's
I think an hair. So a hair is something like 50 microns.
That's close. So we cannot see our hair in superposition.
Well, but you can't see things that you probably can't see things written on your hair, right? It's like this is like sets kind of the lower bound of like your resolution of your eyes.
So okay.
This is something that optical experiments.
Yes,
yeah,
but when we have done
the
experiments in other frequencies as well, astrophysics.
In which case, hopefully, this shifts.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying, why could you just move it over there, go to shorter distances, and then just say everything below 10 to minus 10 is not allowed? I don't know what, I mean, to me, it's a random requirement, so I don't know.
I find it pretty random, but
it looks like we're assuming a specific probe frequency around the optical range. But if you, for instance, did all these experiments with infrared photons or X-ray photons instead, if this whole
it will shift all of it some way or another.
I think this is trying to capture the idea that we don't quote see superpositions. Now, when we say we don't see superpositions, we don't mean we've never done an atom interferometry experiment where we saw evidence for superposition. Obviously, we have. But all the evidence we've accumulated hasn't been by direct perception. And these collapse models are motivated by a notion that, well, it better be the case that, dust particles that I can see in hairs and tables and things like that don't go into superposition because I don't observe them to go into superposition. I'm not saying I endorse that, but that's the kind of spirit. So asking why shouldn't it go down to 10 to the minus 10, the answer is you don't have any direct evidence from your own perception for superpositions collapsing at that length scale. It's not like a baseball. That's the idea. And you also have a lower bound on how quickly you can observe something. And so you can't attest to the fact that superpositions collapse extremely quickly through your own direct perception.
Good. It's good to have you here. Okay, good. So that is that's the landscape. I hopefully make it 10 more minutes or so.
Yeah.
So there's a new map which excludes more. Just some experiments. So that is one experiment which we want to do in my lab, which is based on nanoparticle levitation. So we trap a particle, we drop the particle through a grating, and then we look at the interference pattern. So obviously there's no pattern if you just do it with one particle, so you have to do it with many. And then you see, something like this. So there's a quantum carpet, and if you cut, a line here, then that is a specific drop time from the grating to the detection here, and then you would see many particles here, almost no particle here, many particles here. So like an interference pattern in the distribution of particles over position. That's a proposal which we have worked out in detail for 1 million atomic mass units, so that would improve the actual limit by two orders of magnitude. So that's about 20 nanometer in size nanoparticle, which has to be trapped here. And the experiments which we are doing, and I think I will not have much time to talk about this, is actually how to do this trapping so that this, optical levitation, optical cooling by parametric feedback, and all these kind of things. This is this macro proposal, which is led by Rainer Kaltenbeck, where the idea is to, 2040 or something like that. So that is for after the LISA experiment to test gravitational waves with this, three satellite space telescope, to have another scientific goal in space. And that would be the idea for a platform to bring these nanoparticle interferometer, the one which I showed you before, into space and do this metawave interferometry experiment there. There's maybe, and that is, I will skip the experiment. I talk about these tests here. Now is this question to, I started to work on this collapse models with T.P. Singh and Angelo Bassi maybe 5-6 years ago. And by working mean for my end, it means to think about how to test this. And what you can, you know, easily see is that if you do a direct test in metawave interferometry, then that is a very tough job, right? So you have to increase the mass by quite a lot, and you have to, keep it for longer, and that is technically not really easy. So the question was, could we, come up with something different? Can we do something else? And the answer is yes. And now the approach is the following, is to say, okay, so we know there is, if you take this model seriously, then there is this W, which is this external noise, and that should be universal. It's, out there, like in ether, but it's a classical one. It's not like the Higgs ether. And that should in principle perturb any system, any quantum system. So the first thing we looked at was the two-level system, so the Drosophila of quantum optics. And then, there are all these broadening processes where you basically perturb this excited state, and then you shorten the lifetime and you get broadening. So that is the spectral line of this transition here, and then you get the broadening and the shift, and in principle you get both effects if the noise is now this collapse noise. And then we worked this out for, hydrogen atom harmonic oscillators, double well, so this, famous umbrella potential kind of thing. And you see the numbers are really ridiculously small, so even I would agree that that is, not feasible for an experiment. And we said, okay.
I can believe those numbers.
Yes, but, okay, so I also believe them, but they're too small to do tests. Mm-hmm. So that was a bit disappointing, but then we thought, okay, so what if we go back to the stuff we know, which is this, optomechanical, very heavy systems, and now maybe explain a bit more this optomechanical system. So here you have an optical cavity with an optical mode, so light is bouncing back and forth. That is a solid mirror, and this mirror is movable, so that can basically displace, and it displaces if there is light pressure, so the light can basically move it, and also this mirror moves, it changes the light mode. So there's a coupling which can be shown to be even strong in the quantum optics sense. So you have a strong coupling between the light mode and the motion of this oscillator. So now that is a very massive thing, and you can precisely read this by the light field. So you can basically map the mechanical state of this oscillator into a resonance which you measure optically. And now this thing here, the motion of this thing, is affected by this noise, by this background noise. So it jiggles it around. And now you again have this effect that it broadens the feature. So now that is a zoom into the spectral feature, like a Lorentzian. And you see the blue one is without the noise, and the red one is with noise. It's zoomed in because it's still a tiny effect. But there's some scaling. We did a mistake in the first paper with the scaling. It's not a linear scaling with mass. There's a resonance effect, so it depends on the shape of the object and the dimensions of the object, and then you find the maximum of the effect for a certain mass. So that is an old idea, which was by Philip Pearl, and then others also worked on this, and that is now basically put into the scenario of an optomechanical setting of this modern technology which is there, and also applying it to one of Adler's models, and it seems that with this it is possible to test it. So that was 2014, and then it went pretty fast, so that's the exciting thing. There was a guy, Andrea Vinante, in Leiden, in the group of Tjerk Osterkamp, and they did an experiment not with the levitated particle but with the cantilever. So it's a magnetic ball which they put in a dilution fridge at 10 millikelvin to measure, and they scan it over a substrate, and they can measure something like single electron spins, which is incredible sensitive resolution. So it's a force sensor to measure magnetic forces. And he had this calibration curve. So he measured the temperature of this oscillator against the temperature of the cryostat, and he saw that up to this point of, some 20 whatever Kelvin, a millikelvin, there was an agreement between the temperature which he read at the cryostat and the temperature which he measured from the power spectral density, so basically the area under the resonance curve in the frequency spectrum. And if you apply this to our map of lambda and RC, then now you exclude this area. So you exclude one of Adler's models, and you exclude a good part of the second one. And now Andrea has done the second experiment, and he what he observes. So this is a technical noise, which was because of the specifics of this experiment, and they understood that it was some, you know, technical heating effect which they had in the system. For the second experiment, I don't have the data. What they observed is that basically the curve, if you extrapolate this to zero, it's not crossing zero. There's an offset of the curve. And they're experts with these experiments, and they tried to explain this with all the heating effects which they know. And now the official reading of the paper, which is really, they're really careful in what they're saying. They say that there's an excess noise in the experiment which they measure, which is still about here, which they cannot explain with technical, reasons or technical details of the experiment. So now, you know, other people try to repeat the experiment, and I don't know. It could be that they find maybe something. Maybe in the end we all have to accept collapse models. I don't know. But now that is the map. Maybe that's good as a final slide. That is now the exclusion map with all these experiments which people have done. I showed you this already. So there was a debate if that is acceptable or not. I think it's just a choice, but you can choose otherwise if you want. So here is this cantilever experiment by Andrea Vinante, which I told you already, which excludes all this. So the, you know, molecular interferometry and atom interferometry would be much smaller here. That's an experiment which we have proposed to do with a levitated particle, also in a 10 millikelvin fridge. What is interesting, you can now take the same kind of equations looking at the noise and can apply it to this gravitational wave detector. So there are also big masses which are controlled really precisely because that's what they need to do in order to measure gravitational waves. So if you look at the noise which is shaking these big mirrors, you find, you know, that all this here is excluded. So, you know, there can be no model here. Also LISA Pathfinder. So the Pathfinder mission, which was successful in space, where they have two of those cubes which they stabilize interferometrically against each other. It's a very precise position measurement of a big mass. They don't find noise, so they exclude this area. There's another effect which comes in from here that is X-ray. So if there is this noise, then it would mean that every charge would be kicked and accelerated, and it should emit radiation. So there's an experiment in Gran Sasso in the underground laboratory where they actually look for dark matter for many, many years, and they have a block of pure germanium, and they look at emissions in the X-ray in a specific frequency range. And they don't see nothing, and they do this very precisely, and they correct basically, make it good noise budget, and they extract all kind of effects which they see, and they basically lower and lower the bound, and that they don't see any radiation, so that excludes basically this region here. So now that's a specific one, and because it looks only at the specific frequency range, so it does not test all the models, because in the CSO model the noise is wide, and that's very general. But there's also, you know, good discussion. What color should the noise have? So if you would know more about the physics, you could guess the noise. So that is really interesting. So if you would measure the noise at some point, you could also, of course, measure what the effect is, if it's gravity or not. So with this, I stop. I maybe should thank the guys who do the experiment, which I have not shown to you. I passed by, huh? Yeah. Okay. So that's my group doing the experiments, postdocs and PhD students. There's theory. So Mauro Paternostro, he's doing all the quantum optics stuff. Yunshi Kim and Sugata Bose. So there are some proposals, which I also have not talked about, where you can actually, if you have two massive systems and you do two atom molecule or nanoparticle interferometers beside each other, you can look for an entanglement which is mediated by gravity. That's a proposal which we had with them that would also test the gravity. There's this foundations of physics stuff. So Angelo Bassi for the collapse models, it all started with T.P. Singh in Mumbai at the Tata Institute, who, you know, attracted both Angelo and I to work together. And there's also André Grosshardt on this Schrödinger models. And then all the money, and I would like to thank you for attention.
You asked the question, is gravity like Coulomb. So it turns out if you take two identical charges, put them in a circular orbit, and you calculate the power for electromagnetic quadrupole radius, it turns out the formula is identical to gravitational
waves.
First obtained by Einstein. Except that you have Q squared instead of Cm. And again, the ratio is about 10 to the 40 between the quadrupole electromagnetic radiation and gravitational radiation. This is why it's so difficult to measure gravitational waves. In fact, you need two black holes of 30 solar masses each crashing into one another to see the strain of 10 to the minus 21. So the numbers, the gravity is working badly against you all the time. But huge numbers.
I know.
Well,
yeah, no, you're right, yeah. But
what's the history of gravitational waves? 100 years. Einstein said, it's so small, vanishing is small, you'll never measure it. He was wrong, okay? But think what it took to do this. So here, I don't see how the numbers are always against you.
What is the connection here with why do we care about gravitational waves? So we can, like, use Cavendish experiments to measure things in the laboratory. And then what makes this hard is that we want to basically superpose things large enough to measure
masses.
Right, but the gravitational waves, the smallness of them has nothing to do with the smallness of H bar, right?
Why not?
No. What's it connected to? Where does quantum mechanics come in?
That's the question, isn't it?
I just think these are. I agree that G is small and that gravitational experiments
are
hard.
Small.
But the hardness of this one and the hardness of gravitational waves, I want to say that those are, in some sense, logically distinct. And that
the world was described by Newtonian gravity, this experiment would still be hard.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The
I don't claim it's an easy experiment.
The superposition one.
Yeah.
No, if the world was when you say the world is described by Newtonian
without gravity, any gravitational waves, essentially, infinite speed of propagation of gravitation, like Newton said.
Exactly.
Then this experiment would still be difficult.
Exactly.
All you have to do is put in Gm of I into Schrodinger's equation and solve for the energy separation. Yes. It's incredibly small. It's right there.
That's what he's trying to measure.
There's your H bar.
So, you mentioned at one point that Schrodinger had done a calculation to rule out the possibility of a theory wherein charges that you took like psi squared and you consider that like a charge distribution. So I assume that theory would be something like, you know, it's called Schrodinger-Coulomb theory, where the waves are obeying a classical wave equation, and the sources for that classical equation are the expectation values of the charge operator, and the matter is obeying a nonlinear Schrodinger equation, where the Coulomb potential term, something like the presence of other charges is given by their wave function square, something like that. So the idea is that that theory is ruled out because of spectra, atomic spectra.
Yes.
So I just want to mention that seems very similar to the idea of ruling out Schrodinger-Newton theory based on planetary dynamics.
Yes, yeah. And if there's a path, then yes, yeah. That would be cool, if there's a possibility. Yeah.
The other thing I wonder was this Schrodinger-Newton theory, it seems like because it's nonlinear, it should allow for faster than light.
So it allows, yes, it does. Which, some people are not shocked.
So the people who work on this just grant that relativity theory.
It's clear it's not the final theory. It's maybe an interesting direction to, poke forward, so to say. And, superluminality is something which, maybe could be solved later. So they don't see it as a as a showstopper and something which would prevent you from still working at the model at the present state.
So they think of it as a non-relativistic approximation to some deeper theory that might
make
quantum gravity in a similar way.
For instance, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Another question, what was the limit, Arndt's experiment from 8 years ago, which set the world record for the number of atomic mass units, what prevented that? Like, what was the fundamental limitation to doing better? I didn't quite, you mentioned that you have a proposal for getting two orders of magnitude better, but I didn't really understand what the limiting factor of the previous best experiment.
It's technology, it's the sources. So you don't have sources to bring, big particles, which are larger than what they have already, in sufficient numbers into the gas phase. So you want to have a coherent beam. If you work with these thermal sources, then they go everywhere, and you have to collimate and select, and then you have only very few which make it. If the mass gets larger, then you have to go up with the temperature to get them out, so they go even more and even faster. And so then, so Marcos, actually, I think he spent the last, or maybe even longer, 10 years to try every, source which was there from physical chemistry, so ion sources, laser desorption, all these different technologies, but there is seemingly no way to.
The problem is getting it into the gas phase.
Yeah, to make a beam of those
molecules. It wants to do what? It wants to be a liquid or a solid? Is it?
So, for instance, if you have a big, what you need in the oven is a sublimation process that goes from the solid directly to the gas phase. If the particle is larger, then the van der Waals bond is stronger. So it takes more energy, a higher temperature to separate this. So you're in a different spot in your phase, the thermodynamical phase, is it also the phase diagram? It's not the phase space, it's a phase diagram. So you go through the liquid phase and then it spits out liquid and you can forget it. And then you have to change the pressure to go back in a sublimation range. And it's very complicated.
And the idea is that if I need too high a temperature to get into the gas phase, then...
And then also you cook the stuff in the oven. Yeah?
So the problem is that if it's too high a temperature, it radiates at a wavelength that's too small, and therefore...
That's also, that's also the coherence effect, that comes on top of it.
So that's not the fundamental... I guess I'm asking, why not just crank up the temperature? What's the problem? The problem is mostly that you just can't collimate the beam enough?
Yeah, so you get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So it gets faster, it gets broader. So if it gets faster, the Boyle wavelength goes down. So you have to slow them. There is no technology like you have for cold atoms, right? So the genius part of cold atoms is that you can make them cold by optics. So you do Doppler cooling, and you can make a MOT, and you can make a BEC, and you do this all with lasers. But you only can do it because you have a closed two-level system where you can, cycle the excitation many, many times, and you can impart a lot of momentum to the center of mass motion. For molecules, you cannot. They have a much more complex internal structure. So, whenever you don't have a closed two-level system, you always dump energy into the internal state. So you heat up the molecule. And if you go, within laser, if you would think about lasers, if you would try to heat with a laser, you heat the molecule and you simply explode the molecule. So there is no deceleration technology for big molecules. There is no collimation technology for big molecules. So, all these kind of optical elements which you have for atoms so that you can make nice, intense collimated beams, that is not there for this big stuff. So that was the reason why I thought, let Marcos play with this. He's the best in doing this, picking out stuff and doing it. I'm sure in a year or so, he will, improve the mass limit by an order of magnitude. Yeah, so they're working on this and they have lots of machinery to do this. But my approach was to try different technology, which is this optomechanics, levitated optomechanics, where you have a single particle and you prepare this really well, so you cool it. I didn't have time to go into the details, but you just have a single particle, you cool it to a low temperature, and then you drop this and then do it one by one, instead of having a beam of hundreds or thousands of them, which you cannot control individually. We will see who wins. That's probably Marcos.
How many times do we have to repeat this in order to get your...
Yeah, it depends, how good the counting statistics has to be. So, I don't know, 10,000, 100,000 times. And of course, you have to keep this thing stable. Yeah. So that is the big problem also in our case, is to get the next particle fast enough into the trap. Yeah. So you want to do one cycle in less than a second, and that is quite challenging. Yeah. Okay, thanks.